Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are British historian and author of Entitled, The Rise and Fall of the House of York, Andrew Lowney, and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Andrew Jarecki. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us, remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Mint Mobile, Trust in Will, and Delete Me in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, Trump's State of the Union was supposed to be a reset for a president with terrible poll ratings and a party facing a midterm drubbing. It failed. It instead was a narcissistic-driven, often venomous, 108-minute half tirade, half reality show. Now, he may have excited his base a little. I gleaned that from Fox News, but that was the easy part. His mission was to persuade more voters, independents, soft Republicans, Latinos, that the economy is great, a golden age. Affordability is a Democratic hoax. If you don't believe that, he said, most do not, you're fools. That was Joe Biden's mistake on steroids. Yeah, he lied a lot. Tariffs aren't paid by foreigners. They're paid for largely by Americans. He said there are multiple states where gas averages less than $2.30 a gallon. There are none. But what's new? Trump lying is like Michael Jordan dunking and Renee Fleming singing. Unbelievably. Now, you're going to say I'm naive. I confess. He criticized the Democrats for corruption. Astounding that a president using the Oval Office for unprecedented personal enrichment, and his peace envoys, Witkoff and Jared Kushner, involved in clear conflicts of interest, would do that. Trump campaigning against corruption, James, is like the Boston Strangler railing against crime. It's a travesty. The final word on the Democrats. I give them an A-. Al Green made a fool of himself, waving a sign in front of the chamber, and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib played right into Trump's hands by shouting back at his lies. But other Democrats just sat there, cheering for athletes and military heroes, but refusing to rise to his bait. That really irritated him, you could tell. A number stayed away with a less than sterling rally on the mall. Next year, Speaker Hakeem Jeffries should call on the president to send a written State of the Union message, perhaps, as used to be done, and tell Trump to hold his political rallies elsewhere.
Well, I guess... A couple of things. Number one is exactly what you'd expect from him. To the extent that anybody had a 0.1% feeling, well, maybe he'll change the way he is, and because people are just reacting so negatively to who he is, he would try to be conciliatory and gracious. Of course, that never happened. I think the most telling and comical thing of the entire comedy was the new CBS anchor, Tony Dukaphil, or I mispronounce his name. He said he thought it was one of the great speeches of all time. How you have any credibility with any, I mean, look, you got to try a little bit. You got to fake it a little bit, okay? I mean, you can't even do that. Talk about this is like the modern day version of Gettysburg Address, it's just where we are.
James, that went by. Who said that?
Tony Duke, the guy that
at CBS. Yeah, yeah, that's right. The Barry Weishand.
I'm surprised because I'd have thought they'd have been a little smarter than that. You know, well, no doubt its speech would have great appeal to his voters, and, you know, you could soften it up a little bit without looking like the biggest goddamn jackass in the country.
Boy, you sure
which
do.
Which you do now.
You know, in addition to the nasty demagoguery, it was irresponsible in several ways. He is preparing for a possible war in Iran, readying massive forces. He should, under the law, ask Congress, which, of course, he won't. But he owes the public an explanation. Why? One, is it to take out their nuclear facilities? Well, he told us last year that they already have been obliterated, so I guess we can rule that out. Two, is it their miserable human rights record and executions? Well, then is he going to attack Russia or Saudi Arabia or China? Three, if it's about regime change, he needs to explain why this would not be as disastrous as Iraq. And I have something else that really bothers me. There is no more cherished honor than the Congressional Medal of Honor, given for extraordinary bravery and gallantry at the risk of lives. In some other areas, sports, media, entertainment, prizes can have a political coloration, not with the Medal of Honor and those two recipients Tuesday night, Army officer Eric Slover and 100-year-old Navy veteran of World War II and the Korean War, Royce Williams, are deserving heroes. But Trump politicized those tributes last night, even having his wife put the medal around Captain Williams. That debases not the recipients, but the iconic honor. And it just, it's just what he does. He's cheap.
Yeah. And he has no class. He has no dignity. He has no anything. Yes. And he, of course, he delivered a grotesque speech because he's a grotesque person. He's not going to change. The only thing I can tell you is the public has caught on to it. And your act is coming to an end, and it's not that far away. But we're already going to be in pretty soon in the third month of the year. We know what happens at the beginning of the 11th month of the year, don't we?
Yeah, you know, while he was speaking, Democrats were picking up state legislative seats in Pennsylvania and Maine. That showed you his great clout.
Well, one or two legislative races.
Yeah. You know, on the Democratic response, Abigail Spanberger, that's always a near impossible task. She did it very well, considering perfect setting, Colonial Williamsburg, small audience, and a strong message. No harm. That's what you want out of that. One kick I get, James, I confess, is watching J.D. Vance sitting behind him. When he belatedly realizes Trump has said something that's supposed to be funny, he suddenly breaks out into this awkward, awkward grin. Vance has been put in charge of rooting out corruption. Now, James, I really want your opinion on this. Do you think he's going to dig into the massive crypto scam?
Shit. Root out corruption. Maybe documented $1.5 billion, and everybody says that's low. Again, I'm going to say it just right now. More has been stolen since January the 20th, 2025, to today than was stolen from March of 1789 through the end of the year 2024. So ridiculous that he's doing that. The whole thing is just so ridiculous on his face, and he just keeps doing the same thing. I don't know. The best person I thought had the best night even is Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. You know what he did? He just got up and walked out. He said, I just couldn't take the lives anymore. He didn't bang anything against the wall. He didn't scream at anybody. He didn't say anything. He just walked up and left. Which is the best thing.
Well, I wish I could have done that. If it weren't for our responsibilities to all of our wonderful listeners and viewers, James, I would have left about 9:07. But, you know.
Well, he just carried his ass. He said, I can't listen to this anymore.
I heard this.
One thing I got a bone to take out, Albert. Trump says the first duty of any president is protect the American people. Okay, that sounds. However, if you read the presidential oath, he's really got one job, and that is to protect and defend the Constitution. Which, of course, he doesn't know what the Constitution is, and tries to violate it every other day. And so, the founders thought it was a pretty important job was to protect and defend the Constitution because they put the oath in the Constitution. But no one. But that's the one place. If you want to hide something from Donald Trump, stick it in the Constitution, he would.
Yeah. You know, James, I'm really serious about this. This was most of those people that he cited in the gallery, he spent over half the speech doing that. They're, you know, good people. They've done admirable things or suffered terrible losses. It's not the people that I would do. That's not what a State of the Union is supposed to be. A couple fine. I go back to 1982 when Ronald Reagan started with Lenny Skutnik, who dived into the Potomac to rescue a woman who was drowning after a plane crash. And, you know, all presidents have a couple. That's fine. He grossly overdid it last night. And I really believe that, you know, if he's going to use this just as a, you know, political carnival, that Speaker Jeffries next year should say, fine, send a written message. That's all that's required. It's up to the Speaker of the House to decide whether there's going to be an in-person presidential State of the Union. Doesn't have to be. Usually has not been. So if I were Jeffries next year, I'd say, hey, you want to play that game? You know, have your rally elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't expect anything from Trump. It's exactly, he delivered exactly what I expected. He's actually not very surprising. He just goes from one thing to another because I think he's stupid. By the way, these generals, they're leaking on him like crazy. He thought General Kane was his big friend, so he puts him as head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Then, of course, they leaked through the New York Times that Kane was trying to tell him if he do this, has all kind of consequences.
Yeah.
I mean, Trump got to understand, everybody around him hates him. He's not going to make these 3 years. I'm telling you, they all hate him. They're all leaking on him. The whole White House is leaking like a sieve. He tried to get that Judge Jeanine to indict Senator Kelly and Jason and Slotkin and a whole bunch of other people. Then they couldn't do it. He has surrounded the only person that is really loyal to him is Stephen Miller. That's it, dude. That's who you with. But everybody else, they're looking for their next job. They're trying to figure out how they can get their place in history, not being disgraced by you. And they're leaking on your ass every fucking day. Again, it's going to get worse.
So, James, last night, old Bone Spurs Trump said he deserved a Medal of Honor at some point. You don't think he does, I gather.
I give him the Victoria Cross, the hero of the Soviet Union, the Iron Cross with platinum leaves. He just get the fuck out of here. Give him anything he wants. Give him a medal.
You know, maybe we ought to have the CBS anchor look at those state legislative races results in Maine and Pennsylvania yesterday. I missed that.
I would have thought that CBS had at least been a little more subtle.
Yeah,
that's me.
I'm surprised. I was watching PBS because I'm loyal to my family. Anyway, okay. You know, if you wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable, it's time to upgrade the temperature in your bedroom, you know, and that can make or break your sleep. That's why you need to switch to Miracle-Made sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day. And whether it's too hot or too cold, Miracle-Made sheets truly give you maximum comfort in any weather. They make pillowcases and comforters also. Plus, thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle sheets require way less laundry because they stay clean and fresh 3 times longer. Not only is that fewer wash cycles, but it's great for your skin. Hidden bacteria can clog your pores and cause acne. So sleep cleaner and clearer with Miracle. With no more gross odors, life's a whole lot better for your household. So join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle-Made sheets smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable, they don't have the steep price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some 5-star hotels. So it's a vacation when you get in bed. I imagine myself cruising in the South Pacific with my Miracle sheets. Drift off to dreamland and wake up at the perfect temperature every time you get into bed. Choose Miracle to upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/warroom to try Miracle-Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use promo code WARROOM, you'll get an extra 20% off, plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/warroom with the code warroom at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. The link is in our show notes. Our guest is one of Britain's most prestigious and prolific authors, Andrew Lowney. He has written considerably about the country's elite. Most relevant today, wrote a biography entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York. Well, he knows a lot about the disgraced Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, who's involved in the sex scandal with his pal Jeffrey Epstein and separately of trading state secrets. He was arrested this week. Andrew, let me start with an overarching question. Does this scandal threaten the existence of the British monarchy?
Yes, I think the monarchy is at a crossroads here. It can either carry on as it is, basically being secretive, refusing to answer questions. BBC put a series of questions to Buckingham Palace about what the king knew, and they refused to answer them. Or it can use this as an opportunity to reform itself, to modernize itself, to address the very deep concern among the population that there has been corruption within the royal family. That corruption has been aided to a large extent by a former monarch, the Queen, Elizabeth II, and possibly by the present monarch. And I think it's time for the king to come clean, to say what he knew, when he knew it, and what he did about it. And this is the big problem at the moment, that he's saying nothing.
Yeah, you know, King Charles and his, I think you've written that King Charles and his brother Andrew reportedly loathe each other. The king did strip his brother of his responsibilities, threw him out of his castle, and now his title, no longer a prince. But you believe that Charles did distance himself, certainly with the arrest, but you think he should have acted much tougher and much sooner on this disreputable excuse of a man.
Yes, I mean, the stories about Andrew have been going back in the press for 15 years. There are plenty of opportunities for the palace, for actually the police, and indeed the government to address the problems. I mean, in 2010, Sarah Ferguson was caught on film offering access to Andrew as a trade envoy for £500,000. Nothing happened. 2022, a High Court case revealed that they'd taken £1.6 million, which they couldn't account for, from a gangster. You know, time and time again, these stories have appeared and nothing has happened. So the king can hardly say he didn't know about them. There's plenty of evidence that he was aware that Andrew was trading on, as a trade envoy, was doing his own business on the side with a series of his own business associates. And this is why we want the king to actually explain what he knew and why he didn't act. Was he turning a blind eye to his brother's criminal activities? Has he been perverting the course of justice?
Yeah, that would appear to be a minimum. Look, Charles is 77. He has cancer. In the not too distant future, I expect if the monarch lasts, that William will be the king. Will he be any different?
Well, I think that's the hope. I mean, William isn't largely tainted by the scandal. I mean, he's taken money from someone in the Epstein files. But apart from that, he's a younger generation. I think the feeling is that he will modernize the monarchy. He will make it more transparent and accountable, which is what it needs. And perhaps one has to use the excuse of Charles's illness for him to step aside. That's the general feeling. I think the public feel that there's financial corruption at the center of the royal family and that needs to be cleaned out. You know, Charles has said that the law must take its own course with regard to Andrew. Well, the feeling is that that should also apply to other members of the royal family. No one is above the law, even the monarch.
Yeah. Andrew is not being charged here with his most onerous offense. He settled with an Epstein-arranged very young woman who said she had to have sex with Randy Andy three times. But I think he's being arrested and investigated for sharing confidential financial information with Epstein. It's kind of like Al Capone being convicted of tax evasion, not murder. Will he ever pay a price for his, outrageous behavior and assaulting these young women?
Well, I mean, they brought the charge of misconduct in public office because it's very clear that he was giving away confidential information, not just commercially sensitive information, but also military and diplomatic and political information that he wasn't supposed to share. I think the sex trafficking charges will be leveled against him, but it's clearly taking time to find the girls that were trafficked, to get them to speak. So that will be a longer case. My own feeling is that this is actually a case about national security, and actually what he will be charged with eventually is treason.
Well, James, so you got to help me a little bit because I come from a different perspective, all right? First of all, large Irish family still in Ireland. My family is in County Monaghan, which is Bunsmore Mar, which is the center of bandit country. To say the least, the Coghills, Ireland, are very Republican and very anti-monarchical monarchy. And then I live in New Orleans, and we have Mardi Gras. And for the life of me, I find the thing kind of humorous that these people take themselves seriously, like they really have a job. And then, of course, Andrew, or whatever the shit he does. But when I go to London frequently, I kind of like I say, to me, it's Mardi Gras. Okay, good. They got like nice horses and stuff like that. But as to people that live or in the UK, is this upsetting them? Or do they have a special connection with the monarchy? Or explain that to me a little bit, because I think the whole thing is just goddamn funny. Except for, you know, obviously the people, the victims of this is not funny at all. To watch them all dress up and, you know, setting up meetings, trade meetings, and making money. And then thinking that you're any better than the, you know, county commissioner from somewhere in New Jersey, about the same thing.
Well, I think, you know, this is about corruption. The monarchy survives on the basis of trust and respect. And if it loses that, that's why we give them their special privileges. That's why we pay large sums of money as taxpayers for their homes and for their security and everything else. Once they betray that trust by not by basically putting their noses in the trough, lining their own pockets off the back of what should be public duties, then they're clearly going to be unpopular. And with a cost of living crisis in Britain, the population doesn't take kindly to the fact that they're paying, for example, for Andrew's massages, that he abused his position as a trade envoy to make money for himself. And that seems a very obvious case of corruption in public life.
But didn't the Queen pay $12 million to a woman in the United States to try to settle something for Andrew? I mean, that was money in the royal treasury. It had to come from somewhere, didn't it?
Well, $12 million was paid hush money to Virginia to basically make her go away. And that, again, is one of the big questions. Where did this money come from? Did it come from public funds, or did it come from the Queen's own private wealth? And again, they've been very secretive about that. So that's, again, exercising people about, you know, how honest are the royal family about actually what happened.
Do you have an estimation of how damaged this government is, and will it have to call an election anytime soon?
Well, I mean, the government is damaged in respect to the fact that they allowed Peter Mandelson to become British ambassador in Washington when they were warned that he had these dealings with Epstein. He had already resigned twice over various activities he'd been involved in, and they ignored the advice of the intelligence services. Keir Starmer will remain at the moment in power because there's no one who wants to take on that job at the moment. The government is very unpopular. They don't have to have an election for many years. So it makes sense to let him be the lightning conductor to take all the flak and then move in nearer the election. So we've got a very unstable situation at the moment, but we haven't got a change of government. In any case, there wouldn't be an election. All that would happen would be a change of party leader.
Let me just back up a second. You think that the Labour Party will just pick a new leader as opposed to calling an election right now?
Well, we have a rule that we have 5-year terms, so they don't need to call an election. If they called an election, they'd lose it. I think they will be very unpopular. We have local government elections in May. We have actually quite an important by-election on Thursday, tomorrow. But it's not going to change the government. It's just going to make the government even more unstable than it is.
Okay, thank you. All right, yeah. Alvin.
Andrew, I gather from what you're saying, you expect not only will Andrew Mountbatten Windsor go to trial, he's likely to be convicted, maybe for treason. Can you imagine the scenario where he goes to prison?
Well, I mean, we're a long way off him going to prison. They need to make their case. They need to charge him. There needs to be a trial. I think there's a strong argument with the material that's been leaked from the Epstein files, but also material that I've got and that is becoming will become public shortly about the treason allegations. But stories are already appearing in the press about the national security element to this. But there's many a slip between cup and lip. They may argue that he wasn't a public official. They may say that they're legal technicalities that can't allow him to be tried, that he wouldn't get a fair trial. The bar is very high for misconduct in public office. And so I think we're a long way off any charges being laid. I think that the Crown Prosecution Service and the police will say that he's been, it's going to take a long time to investigate this, and they're going to kick it into the long grass.
I think Keir Starmer is better than most of his predecessors. That's a faint compliment. But when he appointed Mendelsohn in 2025, he knew he palled around with Epstein, who was a sexual predator. I mean, when he says Mendelsohn wasn't forthright, really? I mean, that just is incredible. Was general knowledge that this guy, Peter Mendelsohn, was pretty much of a sleaze?
Yes, it was very well known, and I think that's where Starmer's got problems. He was warned by the intelligence services not to appoint him, and he chose to ignore that. He thought that he would be able to deal with President Trump, and he made a misjudgment, and that's one of the criticisms of Keir Starmer. His judgment isn't good.
Well, boy, it sure wasn't in this case. You know, with Andrew and Mendelsohn, London has, at least in the beginning, in comparison, been tougher than the United States on people, public officials, counting Andrew as one of those. What's the attitude of the British public towards all that, both towards what's going on there and also as they look across the pond?
Well, I think the British public feel that these people need to be held accountable on both sides of the Atlantic. They feel justice has to be served for the victims. They feel there are elites who operate in their own interests. There's a very strong sense that that there needs to be change. That's why we're getting the sort of pressure we are on social media. That's why the press has been more emboldened to deal with the issue, because there is this very strong sentiment amongst the public that justice needs to be served.
Andrew, thank you so much. This is really, you know, it fascinates us from across the pond, too. Whatever you think of the British monarchy, I don't particularly revel or relish it. But anyway, you are the great expert, and you have certainly educated us today. So thank you so much for being with us.
That's a pleasure.
Every group has someone who insists on doing things the hard way. A friend still paying for a subscription they forgot they had. The one who refuses to update their phone because it still works. And now they are the one who somehow still overpaying for wireless in 2026. Luckily, Mint Mobile is here to help with that last one. So stop paying way too much for wireless just because that's how it's always been. Mint exists purely to fix that by giving you the same coverage and same speed without the inflated price tag. You get the premium wireless you expect, complete with unlimited talk, text, and data at a fraction of what others charge. And for a limited time, get 50% off a 3, 6, or 12-month unlimited premium wireless plan. Bring your own phone and number, activate with eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately with no long-term contracts and no hassle. Add in a 7-day money-back guarantee and customer satisfaction ratings in the mid-90s, and Mint makes it easy to try and see why people don't go back. We strongly recommend you make the switch to Mint Mobile. We may not be the most tech-savvy, I think you could say that, but James and I could handle it easily. The website is incredibly simple to navigate, and we were able to get down to business in no time. That's when you'll know that you have to get our kids and grandkids using it too. Like all of you, they have a lot more important things to use their hard-earned money for than another bill. It's ready to stop paying more than you have to? New customers can make the switch today and for a limited time. Get unlimited premium wireless for just $15 a month. Switch now at mintmobile.com/war room. That's mintmobile.com/war room. The link is in the show notes. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for a 12-month plan required. $15 a month, equivalent taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only over 50 GB may slow when network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. Additional terms apply. See mintmobile.com. Hey, James, we're talking to accomplished filmmaker Andrew Jarecki. He has done a documentary on the atrocious conditions in the Alabama prison system. 277 deaths last year, inmates brutalized, rampant drug use, and few rehabilitation programs. But Andrew, there are a lot of terrible state systems. Louisiana and Mississippi come to mind. Why did you choose Alabama?
Well, originally, I didn't really choose to make a film about prison at all, but I've been interested in all the problems in our prison systems. And we got access to one prison, Easterling Prison in Alabama, because we met a chaplain who was doing a revival meeting there. And the warden was allowed, was allowing us to do that. And that was really an extraordinary window because we went in there and we started meeting men who immediately said to us, the situation in here is urgent. They're killing people regularly. Guards are killing people. People are dying of drug overdoses at the highest rate in the country, suicides at the highest rate in the country. And the people bringing in the drugs are the guards. So the Alabama Department of Corrections is not only the largest law enforcement group in the state, it's also the largest drug dealing operation. And we recognized that those men were not really going to be able to talk to us on camera. And then eventually we get nosy and we sort of get thrown out of that prison. And then we discovered that there is a network of incarcerated leaders inside that prison system who have access to contraband cell phones. And so for the first time, we were able to make a film where it wasn't just what you got to see curated by the prison authorities, but we were really seeing the unvarnished truth through the cell phone cameras of men who are currently incarcerated.
Yeah, that's what made it so powerful, Andrew. I think you named them, Robert Earl Council, Melvin Ray, sure, and Raoul Poole. They displayed enormous courage. How have they been treated since then?
Well, you know, they've been retaliated against years before we ever met them. And actually, when the film came out at Sundance 2 Januaries ago, the state government didn't really know what to do with it. So they just gave a statement to George Stephanopoulos, somebody that James has some familiarity with, where they said, well, we're aware of the film, but we cannot comment on the authenticity of the material in it, which is kind of like a fake news answer. And they didn't say anything. And since that time, the men, I think, have been somewhat protected by their appearance in the film. And then, quite recently, I would say a month ago, their supporters announced a work strike, and that's a big problem for the state because they get $450 million a year in unpaid labor from prisoners. And as soon as that work strike was announced, all three of the people in our film were whisked into solitary confinement. And so, you know, Alabama doesn't react much to people exhibiting the brutality of what they're doing in the prison system, but they really don't like it when you interfere with the forced labor effort.
Well, tell us the story about Sandra Ray and her son, Stephen Davis.
So Sandy is a regular white mom living in Uniontown, Alabama, a town of about 400 people. And we had never met her, but one of the incarcerated men in the film, when we started making it, had texted us to say, there's been somebody beaten very badly at Donaldson Prison, and you should look into it. He has currently been brought to UAB Hospital. And so we jumped in the car and drove to UAB Hospital, and we sort of just found our way to the room, the ICU room, where this young man was. And by the time we got there, we found that he had passed away. And so he was in a body bag in his hospital room. And immediately we thought, we better go visit, try and find his mother, because often the Alabama State Prison System does not even inform the relatives that somebody in their family has passed away. And especially if the person was the victim of being killed by a corrections officer, which is what happened in this case. And so we went to Uniontown, and we were on the porch at Sandy Ray's house, and she had just lost her son just hours before that. And she said, if you guys are making a film about this, I want to help you. I don't want this to happen to any other mom. And so, you know, here she is in her, she's got an oxygen tank. She's living in this tiny town in the middle of nowhere in Alabama. And she said, teach me how to record my phone calls. I know that they're lying to me right now. The prison is calling to tell me that my son attacked the guards, or that it was his fault that he was murdered. And so we were able to embed with her as she started to hear the cover-up coming out of the prison. And that was a very powerful experience.
What happened to the guard who killed him?
Well, so far, nothing has happened to the guard who killed him. His name is Roderick Gadsden, and it's undisputed that Gadsden killed Stephen Davis. And it's an unusual situation. You have a black prison guard who's killed a young white, blonde white kid, and has been able to do it with total impunity. In fact, despite the investigation that we did in the film, which makes it clear through dozens of witnesses that he was observed murdering somebody, he has been promoted twice since the incident.
And promoted.
They're just acting like, yeah, I mean, you know, they essentially reward this kind of behavior because they like to run their prison system with almost no staff. And so you end up bringing in these incredibly brutal guards. And it was just a big expose in the Guardian saying, you know, this man may be the most violent prison guard in America. Why is he still working at the Alabama Department of Corrections? And that's question I think people are asking.
The governor of Alabama said, it's our problem, we can fix it. Well, they sure as hell haven't fixed it. Why hasn't the federal government tried to take over?
Well, you know, James can tell you that the federal government doesn't have nearly as much power in these states as we imagine they do. So the DOJ started an investigation into the Alabama State Prison System, and they came out with these two findings letters that basically said, this is the most brutal and most deadly prison system in America. And Alabama's response to it was not to say, oh, okay, well, we're a little bit embarrassed by that, and of course, we've got to do better, or we'll enter into a consent decree with you and try to, you know, have a monitor or something. They just said, this is not true. It's just anecdotal. It's not the case. You know, we don't have a systemic problem in our facilities. And so the DOJ did very little, even though it was the Trump DOJ that brought the lawsuit, which is, you know, seems like quaint, seems like a long, long while ago now. But in today's world now, Trump's DOJ is taking the view that the Civil Rights Division is all about, you know, pursuing anti-white bias, and that whole division that was designed to protect people who were in the worst prisons, right, places where there were the most egregious offenses by police officers or corrections officers, you know, it's not like the DOJ was taking on, you know, cases that were marginal. They were taking on the worst cases of systemic problems in these states, and now all those lawyers are gone.
James, so what has changed since you've made this film? And more importantly, what do you hope changes going forward? If anything changed the way they do business?
I would say that, you know, they know that they're being watched now. They know that millions of people have seen this film on HBO. We've had 100 screenings across Alabama. There have been people protesting on the steps of the Capitol. Just maybe 3 or 4 days ago, there were a few hundred people that showed up with pictures of their loved ones on the steps of the Capitol, people who had died in the custody of the state. And so there's a much higher level of awareness because, you know, they can't deny the visibility of it. They can't deny that it's happening if it's on video. And these whistleblowers inside have been able to prove that it's happening. So now they're sort of stuck with that. And most recently, you know, Kay Ivey, who's done some incredibly destructive things. I mean, she was the one that said, we're going to solve this prison problem by building mega prisons, which is a crazy idea and an economic disaster for Alabama. And she promised that she'd build three new mega prisons for $900 million. She didn't have the money to do it. She raided the COVID funds that she was getting from the federal government to pay for the prisons. Then she announced that she still didn't have enough money to do it. And so she was going to take $100 million from the education budget and put that toward these new prisons that the DOJ doesn't even want her to build. So Kay Ivey is sort of very bad news. And I think she's just either blind to the problem, willfully blind to the problem, acting like it doesn't exist. And so what we've seen recently with this sort of public outcry, I think maybe the funniest thing that has happened, if it wasn't so tragic, is that she said nothing for a year, and then the film got nominated for the Academy Award a couple of weeks ago, and she immediately came out with a statement basically saying, you know, the Oscars are for losers, and by the way, she's the greatest governor in the history of the state, and she's been so helpful in improving the prison problem.
So let me, you said something earlier in the show, and I just want it because I'm in Pacific Ocean, and we're here, that's right. That they are a group of prisoners, a cabal, that the prison administrators allow to have certain devices? Is that what you said?
Well, it's not that they allow it. It's that, you know, the prison administration says that the men cannot speak to the press, right?
Okay.
And so it happens that there is a contraband cell phone trade inside the prisons, which allows the men to get the word out. And in fact, in this case, sort of in collaboration with us, because we were in a position to make a film about it. And so even though it's ostensibly illegal, the cell phones are all coming in from the guards, right? So it's sort of like the, you know, the guards are the ones that are providing the devices that are allowing us to reveal the abuses by the guards and the administration.
So if you were nominated, you know, the Academy Award is coming up, do you think if you got nominated and won that would give this film more impact if really wanted to reform your business?
You know, the film did get nominated, and that's why she came out with this sort of reaction. You know, she said the Oscars, we always knew the Oscars had a low bar. And by the way, she's an amazing governor for prisoners. But clearly they do not want the film to advance any further. They certainly don't want it to win an Academy Award. You know, they act in Alabama like they just don't succumb to any kind of public pressure, that they've got their own version of reality. They don't care. The state motto is, we dare defend our rights. You know, some state's motto is like, welcome, we have, you know, beautiful sights and views and mountains. In Alabama, it's we dare defend our rights. And so their attitude is, we do not want anyone on the outside telling us what to do with our prisoners. But it's very clear that the pressure does have an impact on them. Nobody likes this. Nobody likes to be a legislator in Alabama and be seeing a film that shows that you are overseeing death camps in your own state paid for by taxpayers.
Well, I hope you win, because not only, I mean, you're a terrific filmmaker. Before I let you go, tell us about some of the other works that you've done to give our viewers some perspective on your career as a documentarian.
Sure. Well, James, you and I met long before, but my first film that I made was called Capturing the Freedmans. And that film was really about in and around the justice system, but it was working on that film that brought me into Dannemora Prison in upstate New York to see sort of the brutality of even how they treated visitors in that prison. So since that time, I've tried to visit prisons as much as possible. And then eventually I saw the other side of the justice system, because I started making a film about Robert Durst, who had killed three people over 30 years, but was also part of a billionaire family in New York. And Robert Durst was allowed to get away with murdering a lot of people because the authorities didn't really want to go up against him because they knew he was going to have unlimited resources and because there were a lot of people protecting him. So I got to see in making this film sort of the how the justice system works for the most impoverished people who don't have representation, who don't have any control over what prisons they go into or any of that. And then I got to see it in making The Jinx. And in The Jinx, you know, that was a very public phenomenon and that became kind of a sensation because we developed evidence about Robert Durst's life that proved that he had killed these three people. And when it appeared in the film, which was on HBO, it was six episodes. So we reveal that evidence and he actually confesses to murder in the last episode. And he was arrested the day before that episode aired. So that was very dramatic. But it was an example of what happens when, you know, you really can, you do have the power and money to manipulate the justice system.
Oh, wow. Be a filmmaker with impact. We love that. Albert?
Well, you know, we'll let you go, but I can't help but thinking, one of the candidates for governor in Alabama this year is Tommy Tuberville, widely considered the dumbest man in the Senate. When you describe Kay Ivey, she may be the only person on this planet that Tommy Tuberville would be an upgrade. I mean, it really is says something pretty pathetic about Alabama politics, Andrew.
Well, remember on the positive side, James, do not poo-poo this idea, or I'll ask you, do you think it's possible that Doug Jones has a chance to win in Alabama, especially if this prison issue becomes as public as it's becoming?
Yeah, I think Doug. I mean, I've talked to him. He's running. If any Democrat could win in Alabama, it would probably be Doug. And if he could beat any Republican, I mean, you're not going to get Roy Moore again. But Tuberville is—he's pretty good. I mean, it's a damn good matchup in that governor's race. That's all I would say. Before I let you go, because this is something we already talked. How many Epstein films do you think are going to be made in the next 10 years? It's just unbelievable, the material in that for anybody. It might be too much.
No, I mean, I always think that these, like the instantaneous, salacious stories, like, you know, so-and-so killed his wife or, you know, JonBenet or whatever, those usually end up being very boring documentaries. And one of the reasons is you don't have the time and space when everybody in the streaming world is rushing to make a story about, you know, whatever it's going to be. So poor Savannah Guthrie and her mother. I guarantee you that's going to be a five different documentaries at various levels of quality, going down to the most salacious, most terrible. And none of it's going to be true, right? It's all going to be rushed, hurried, because one streamer is trying to chase the other streamer to get it out first. And that's just not ultimately very good investigative reporting. So because we made this film over 7 years, we were able to do it in a very different way. And that's, you know, the great thing about documentary filmmaking and the reason why documentaries are exciting to watch is time compression, right? I'm seeing, James, I watched the film about you that our friend Matt Turnauer made. And the thing that's great about it is I get to compress your entire career in front of my eyes in an hour and a half or whatever. I can really see the arc of your life and I can have a ride along to some of the most interesting things that have happened in, you know, American politics. That's because of the ability to compress time. So for us to be able to show something that's a 7-year story, but compress it so that people can absorb it in its complexity and see beautiful things and see men inside who have been locked away, who have incredible brains and incredible ability to organize and motivate. You know, that's a really exciting thing. And we're you know, really happy to do that. And I will say also for people that want to do anything about the prison crisis in Alabama, if you go to the website, thealabamasolution.com, it's not like a promotional website for the film. It's really a deep dive into what's going on in Alabama. And then there are a bunch of action items that you can do that are relatively easy, like calling the prison system and complaining, which matters.
Jay, Andrew, in the great Carville documentary, were you impressed with our technological capabilities?
I was impressed. I thought you were the best part of it, to be honest. Yeah. I don't even know why.
Listen, good. The best of luck to you. It's a really important story. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Really do appreciate it.
We're very proud of you, man. We're very proud to have you on the show. I think you're going to win. And I think when you win, I think, oh, Leo and his visit to America is going to visit an Alabama prison. That's that would be my fondest dream.
No one wants to talk about what happens when you're no longer around. Unfortunately, it will happen. But you can be prepared with Trust and Will. Online estate planning. Some people still haven't named a guardian for their kids, things that are way too important to put off. Thankfully, it's easier than you think. You can create an estate plan with Trust and Will in as little as 30 minutes. Like all of us, you might have questions. That's why Trust and Will's online platform provides a step-by-step guided process and offers optional one-on-one support from attorneys in your state so you can feel confident in your choices. They even have amazing customer support from real people. We love that Trust and Will believes estate planning should be accessible to everyone. They are committed to making it affordable today and valuable tomorrow, no matter what your situation is. Plus, all of their products are attorney-designed, state-specific, and customized to your needs. We feel secure knowing that Trust and Will was created by legal experts and designed to grow with you, allowing you to easily update your plan at every life stage or transition. You know, we all want our family to be ready for any eventuality. And our young producer got his parents signed up as soon as he heard about it. He says it's not about money, it's about being prepared. Now, time will tell, but I know that Trust and Will puts the future of what you've built in your hands. Add in bank-level encryption and secure sharing features that ensure your most important documents and details stay protected and accessible, and there's ultimate peace of mind. Don't wait until it's too late. Protect your loved ones today, tomorrow, and beyond with Trust and Will, the most trusted name in online estate planning. Go to trustandwill.com/war room and get 20% off. That's trustandwill.com/war room to get your 20% off again. Now, I'm going to tell you one more time, but it's so good. trustandwill.com/war room. The link also is in our show notes. Hey, now for the outrage of the week. I hope everyone gets a chance to read a Washington Post opinion piece by Arne Duncan, former education secretary, and former ambassador to Hungary, David Pressman. They raise questions. Why are some American universities, citing Vanderbilt and Washington University in St. Louis, convening a meeting with the agenda being the Trump administration's crusade against prestigious universities? As they write, these colleges instead should collaborate with others to address some of the real issues higher education faces, affordability, diversity, and taking on Trump's partisan attacks using bogus matters like preventing anti-Semitism. His campaign is all about politics. Some of these universities, as the authors write, are engaged in appeasement when they should be involved in resistance. We know, going back to Munich and further, that appeasement never works. Bullies just see it as weakness. We saw it with the big law firms that capitulated, and they're still handcuffed by their surrender. As a former ambassador to Hungary noted in this article, this is what higher education did in response to Viktor Orban's threats, figuring it was better to cut a deal with him. That only whetted his appetite, and they suffered more. As Duncan notes, those university presidents and trustees who spoke out will be remembered by history. So will those who capitulated to the embarrassment of their grandchildren. The Washington Post article is entitled, "Universities Are Sending Trump a Dangerous Message." Get it?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with you on that, but I'll make also a larger point. Places like Vanderbilt and Washington have tremendous endowments. Okay, they really have protection. I mean, you can't imagine. I probably have $12 billion endowment. And when you look at that and say, these people have all this money and all this prestige, and they're scared to death. They won't use it for anything. That sets a bad example all over the country. So when you go to a place like Vanderbilt, or of course, which are both world-class universities, to say the least, and you taught to stand up for what you believe in, what's right, you say, well, why the fuck should I do it when the people that run this whole place is sitting on $12 billion and allowed themselves to be pushed around by a pack of goons that don't give a shit about any values that we claim that we teach. Can you imagine? I love all these universities. Veritas. Yeah, that's Trump. Veritas. Veritas this.
Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. It's dangerous, and you need someone in your corner. That's why Delete Me does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information from data broker websites. It's not just a passive service. Delete Me sends you regular, personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. But they don't stop there. Delete Me isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you by constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. As public figures, we always knew we could be targets for scammers and worse. But when we found out how many Americans are compromised and at the mercy of criminals, everybody wants to fight back. With Delete Me, you'll feel so much better about your security. But more importantly, as family men, we know Delete Me is something that can help keep our family, loved ones safe. Join us and refuse to be a victim. Start taking steps to protect your privacy with Delete Me. Don't wait. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/war room and use the promo code war room at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/war room and enter the code war room at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/war room, code war room. The link is in our show notes. Okay, now, James, for our listener questions. I'm not going to read the State of the Union questions because we've already done that, but we've got a lot of good ones. Ivan in Los Angeles says, why is there not more sympathy and an equal amount of outrage among the general public for the young women trafficked, abused, raped, and so on by Epstein and company?
I don't know. They seem to be gathering steam out there, right?
Yeah.
It took a while, but I don't think this thing. I don't think it's going to go away. I don't see how it does.
It won't.
You know, let's talk about it a little bit because I've been thinking about this. One of the things is that Democrats can take on in the 2026, because, you know, I'm a big believer we should only do popular things that keep the party united, and then we can deal with the rest of the stuff in 2028, that we would pledge to have a complete and thorough investigation of all things Epstein. Now, that means that if you take the House back, you take the House and the Senate, that you set this up and you run a real investigation. You draw these subpoenas real tightly. You know, you can't trust the Justice Department, but you do as much as you can, get the judiciary and tell people you deserve the truth. And because this thing is, it just so indicative of power acts one way and people without power act another way. It's got a real inherent good larger message. I mean, we can run on Epstein.
Yeah, and everybody should be able to agree on that. I think they do.
Yeah.
Todd in Bellevue, Washington says, I'm a 78-year-old lifelong Democrat. I'm most impressed with John Ossoff. If he wins re-election, what do you think of him as a possible presidential candidate? I think he's a good candidate. I think he's going to win in Georgia. He's raised a lot of money. He's a good senator. I don't see him as a presidential candidate. I see the other senator from Georgia, Raphael Warnock, as a more likely national ticket person. But John Ossoff has turned out to be a good senator, and I think he's going to win in November.
He gave a speech like a week ago that's really good and really got a lot of traction. I know I'm going to a fundraiser for him in New Orleans. He said, May. I tell you, he's hardworking. He's an unbelievably hardworking guy. But yeah, as a result of that speech that he gave, it has stirred interest in his national, but I kind of agree with you. I don't think that Senator Ossoff is going to be the running for president in this cycle, but it wouldn't be surprised if he's further down the line. He's still a relatively young person.
Yeah. Yeah. James, next, Max in San Francisco says California's jungle primary is an Achilles heel. He thinks we need to trim down the field of Democratic gubernatorial candidates as soon as possible. Democrats below 5% should drop out. Do you see the jungle primary as a problem?
You know, I've gone through this stuff. We went through it in Louisiana. Other people have it. I guess in the long run, not so much. I see it as a problem. And a lot of the lesser candidates, when they start falling off, they really start falling off. And then it becomes apparent that there's two or three people that have a chance. It almost guarantees that a Republican gets in a runoff. But if you would have had a primary system, it would have had the same results. I don't know. I'm torn on a jungle primaries, early voting, rank. I mean, not early voting. That's easy. Rank voting. I haven't developed a real strong feeling one way or another.
Yeah, me too. John, in one of my very, very favorite cities, Boston, Massachusetts, asked, did Trump's minions block Colbert's interview with James Tallarico because they want Jasmine Crockett to win the primary because she can't win a general election? John, I don't know what exactly happened. CBS lawyers got involved. CBS has become a rather cowardly network these days, number one. I don't know there's a link, but number two, there's no doubt that Republicans from the White House on down want Jasmine Crockett to win that March 3rd primary because they know, even if she's running against the awful Ken Paxton, that she's going to lose. And Tallarico has a real shot in a general election. And there's no question Republicans did everything they could to get her in the race, phony polls and the like. And Texans better think carefully because the choice may well be either James Tallarico or Ken Paxton.
Absolutely right. They manipulated it to get her in the race because they know that they have a much, much better chance of beating her than they have beaten Jim Tallarico. And there was a poll that was favorable to Crockett, I saw. But the betting markets are really in favor of Tallarico. So I don't know. I guess we'll find out who you're going to believe, betting markets or the polls.
James, this is an interruption, but did you see that Maine Senate poll today?
I saw one that had Tallarico up like 64-32 or something.
Yeah, Plattner is beating the incumbent governor,
right,
2-1. I was astounded by that, but hope he's way ahead of Collins too. So let's hope he.
We'll see. I think the youth movement is, there's really something to it.
And I do too.
Maine is one of the oldest states. We want something other than Mills and Collins, and apparently they determined to get it. Or it seems like it anyway.
Yeah. It's also why Mallory McMurrow, I think, is going to win in Michigan.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
We love those questions. Keep them coming in. James, we have to figure out a way to somehow deal with more questions because they're so good and they say so much about what great listeners we have. So thank you. Keep them coming. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Mint Mobile, Trust and Will, and Delete Me in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them. Because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.